Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump last month tweeted that he would work to save a state-owned Chinese tech giant sanctioned by the U.S. Commerce Department for selling banned technology to North Korea and Iran. Trump's tweet became a reality last week when the administration agreed to restore ZTE's access to its American parts suppliers. Axios reporter Erica Pandy is covering the latest on the revival of ZTE. She joins us by phone. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann, for having me.
First, what is ZTE?
So ZTE is, like you said, a state-run telecom company in China. It's a big company, and it's as close to the Communist Party as you can get without basically being a bureau. And that's because telecom is such a strategic sector for China. You know, they really want to build out their tech industry, move into semiconductors, take on the U.S. in that fight for the smartphone, and ZTE is a huge part of that. So they want to keep it close. It's growing, it's a huge maker of phones, and it's very reliant on American parts, especially the finer parts of the phone.
So why was it banned by the Commerce Department?
Right, so the Commerce Department comes after ZTE violated U.S. sanctions many times by selling, like you said, phones with American parts to Iran and North Korea. ZTE is also in the Pentagon's crosshairs, and it's been banned from military bases out of fear that the company is using its technology to spy on Americans for the Communist Party, for the Chinese government.
So why would the president intervene in this way?
So, it's more about the Chinese than President Trump here. It's when the first ban was doled out, I would say, you know, Wilbur Ross had a huge range of options to punish ZTE for violating sanctions, ranging from a slap on the wrist to a ban so severe that it shut down the company. And when that ban was put in place, it became a top priority issue for Xi Jinping. And China does have the leverage to take back a fight against the U.S. in this trade fight. So when they took that issue to the president, it became, you know, a chip away in this broader trade fight to give that deal on ZTE, and it became part of this bigger trade war. And China used all of its leverage to put it behind this one issue because it was such an important issue, such a strategic issue for them.
And so that's the win for Donald Trump then? He likes to win in these kind of things. What's the U.S. win?
I mean, there isn't really a U.S. win here. It's to be frank, I mean, and the senators who are hawkish on China have said it themselves, ZTE is a bad actor in every sense of the word, and letting them off easy is really not the way to go here. And, you know, no matter how well that plays into the broader trade fight and negotiating with China on tariffs or on other issues, ZTE becomes a national security issue and is just that much more important.
Critics have said that this could set a dangerous precedent for trade negotiations with China. Why is that?
Well, one reason that's true is because another Chinese telecom company that's state-owned, Huawei, is also in U.S. crosshairs. We just found out that Facebook had sold American data to Huawei, and also Huawei has been banned from military bases as well for potentially spying on Americans. So China could, you know, take Huawei to Trump and use the same tactics to free that company from American sanctions as they did with ZTE. It also shows that China has economic leverage against the U.S. and could use that to get a win in the trade war.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the state-owned Chinese tech giants ZTE. It was sanctioned by the Commerce Department for selling banned technology to North Korea and Iran. President Trump has intervened. He tweeted last month that he would restore ZTE's access to its American parts suppliers. My guest, Axios reporter Erica Pandy, has been covering the latest on the revival of ZTE. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators has introduced legislation to reverse the deal. How would that work?
So the amendment jointly introduced by Democratic and Republican senators undoes whatever the latest Commerce Department action is, which is reversing that ban on American products in exchange for ZTE paying a big fine and letting a compliance team that reports to Commerce into their doors. It's, you know, what that would do is basically take us back to that 7-year ban And it's gotten a lot of support, and they've attached it to a must-pass defense bill. So, you know, it still needs to go through the processes, but there's a bipartisan effort to go back to the ban.
That's kind of gutsy for members of the Republican caucus, is it not?
Exactly. I mean, you're right, but they've been so critical of this move and of President Trump, even if they agree with him on other issues. I mean, senators have really been very harsh of this decision because of its national security implications. And so, you know, they're definitely moving forward with it full steam.
Okay, so you've referred to it a little bit, but I haven't asked you what the specifics of the deal. What does ZTE have to do now?
So the specifics of the deal are that they have to change the top leadership who have been found guilty of violating sanctions. They have to pay $1 billion in fines and then $400 million in additional fines. And then this part is actually, you know, good for the U.S. government. They have to let a special team of compliance officers report to the Commerce Department onto their team to kind of watch in real time that they're abiding by sanctions. So that piece of it is actually a good get.
Why is that good?
Because it allows the U.S. to directly monitor and go into a company that closes itself off, that is close to the Chinese government, and directly monitor on the ground whether compliance is actually happening.
And as far as changing the top leadership, doesn't that go to the heart of the Communist Party then in China? And they agreed to it.
Right. I mean, you're right. Companies like this, the top leadership will have a party presence. But I think, I mean, that's not an issue because, first of all, they can replace it with additional party presence. And the ZTE is too important of a company for China to fight with the finer points on the U.S. A deal that reverses that ban is a big win in and of itself.
So what does this mean for Huawei then? Also banned from military bases due to national security concerns about espionage. Does this give them any leverage to negotiate something different?
I mean, there's no telling if they'll bring Huawei to the table, too. But it definitely shows us that China has the wherewithal to save a company like this if they so choose. And they could follow the same precedent for Huawei, in the future and also try to get that company out from under American sanctions.
And if nothing else, the bottom line is China has a friend in the president.
I mean, the president is unpredictable, and if the president sees somewhere where another world leader directly appeals to him and asks for a deal, he could say no, but he could very well say yes. In this case, you know, he acted quickly to reverse that ban.
Do you think any of this has anything to do with North Korea?
I would say that the North Korea angle here is that we definitely need China to comply with U.S. maximum pressure on North Korea. They were a big part in bringing North Korea to the negotiating table.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that China is an important player there and could make or break U.S. efforts in North Korea definitely gives them a big bargaining chip when trying to save their companies or trying to fight back against U.S. tariffs.
What else? I mean, what are you looking at going forward? Is this a done deal now unless the U.S. Senate can introduce legislation that would reverse it, but wouldn't that require the president's signature as well?
Exactly. I mean, that's what we're watching now. The amendment would require the president's signature, but it's attached to a bill that's big and that's important, so that mm-hmm. increases its chances. It just got approved just yesterday, so mm-hmm. there's no telling what the future is for this amendment. But, you know, with so much bipartisan support, it's looking good.
Is it looking as good in the House as well?
I think for all senators and for all House members, being hawkish on China, especially the argument of national security, is not one that they can really fight against with mm-hmm. much gravitas. So I think in the House it has chances just as good as in the Senate.
Okay. Well, Erica Pandy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Erica Pandy, reporter for Axios. She's been covering the issue of ZTE. That's the big Chinese tech giant that was sanctioned by the Commerce Department for selling banned technology to North Korea and Iran. They weren't supposed to be using American parts for 7 years. But President Trump last month tweeted that he would work to save that tech giant, and it became a reality last week. The administration agreed to restore ZTE's access to its American parts suppliers with some caveats, changing the top leadership, $1 billion fine, plus another $400 million in fine, and these compliance officers that Erica told us about who will be involved in reporting to the Department of Commerce in the future about ZTE. We'll be right back. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Electronic Entertainment Expo, commonly referred to as E3, is the premier trade event for the video game industry. That means that Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is on the story. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So the E3 conference, Microsoft and Sony had some big announcements. Tell us about them. Start with Sony.
Yeah, so Sony had a press event last night where they just unveiled a whole bunch of games that are going to be coming within the next couple of years, but also stuff that we can expect to play later this year. And a lot of the big titles kind of feel familiar. They're actually refreshing a very popular game from the original PlayStation and PlayStation 2 called Resident Evil 2. And they've done some really cool stuff with this very kind of gritty-looking game called The Last of Us 2.
Are these pretty dark and scary things, or what?
Most of the things that we saw announced at E3 this year had a trend towards kind of the darker, scarier side of things. There were a couple of very positive, kind of lighthearted games as well, but there was an overwhelming trend towards that kind of dystopian future sort of experience.
Microsoft opened a new studio, bought a bunch of indies. What did they talk about?
Microsoft put together five new studios to tackle a major criticism that has been kind of leveraged against the Xbox platform, which was over the last couple of years. It hasn't had nearly as many kind of single story first player games as compared to the PlayStation 4. And it's true, the Xbox has had a tremendous number of successes with kind of online multiplayer games, but not a whole lot in the way of, just kind of sit on your couch for days at a time and play this game by yourself kind of experiences. And this was an effort to fix that. They've worked with a bunch of different indie game companies, including Ninja Theory, which has been responsible for a lot of games over the last couple of years, and brought them on board as proper kind of Microsoft studios to work on titles specifically for the Xbox.
So you called them single-story first-player games, but you described it more accurately as stories games that you can sit on your couch and play for days on end.
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of a personal preference. You know, there are games like there are games that we've had, especially this year on the PlayStation, like Horizon Zero Dawn and most recently God of War, which are games that don't involve playing with other people. You know, you are sitting and playing a long story over a pretty significant chunk of time, and those are not as rewarding in some ways as big popular online multiplayer games, because people will play the big popular online multiplayer games for longer because they're playing with friends. Mm-hmm. There's not like a dedicated story that you get to the beginning and end of. You're kind of repeating things. And so that there's room for both of these experiences, and Microsoft just happened to lean a little further in one direction than the other.
Hmm. Do you think it was a wise move?
I think, you know, online experiences in general is something that the Xbox has always done better than any of the other game consoles. The ability to play online with friends and have it be a part of this this online service that is just kind of up all the time and works with your phone and works with your computer and does, you know, just kind of a lot to stay connected, almost like its own social network in several respects. And so I think it was a great decision because there are a lot of people who can't really enjoy a game console without a subscription to Xbox Live these days.
Mm-hmm.
And the competing services really just aren't as good.
What else are you looking for at E3?
The biggest thing that we're looking for at E3 is a lot of kind of new experiences. We know that there are things that were announced last year that still haven't made it yet, like Kingdom Hearts 3, which is a game, kind of a huge Disney game that pulls in a lot of different characters and will be on the Xbox and the PlayStation 4 for the first time. And we're also looking at you know, a lot of virtual reality games that were announced, like a game Beat Saber for kind of an athletic, you know, motion-based experience for the PlayStation VR as well.
Right. VR, we've been talking about it a lot in the past year. It's going to get bigger and bigger.
It is, and most of the time it kind of has its own separate space where games and development and things like that get announced. But E3 is one of those places where you know, things for PlayStation VR tend to come out as well.
And we talk sometimes about the storylines. Are you pleased with the direction they're going?
There's definitely a trend towards the dark right now.
Right.
There are a lot fewer in the way of kind of uplifting stories that have come out over the last year.
Why do you think that is?
I think that it's a storytelling mechanism that keeps people really interested in talking about it. You know, this is you know, we trend this way a lot with movies too. There are groups of people who they love talking about scary movies and you know, the things that shock them in some way or another get them to talk to their friends about it. So it's kind of a natural way to get people's attention.
All right. So HTC U12, it's a weird phone with no buttons. What does that mean?
Yeah,
how does that
so
work?
This phone has ridges on the side of its body, you know, these kind of metal spaces that look like a power button and a volume button, but they don't actually move up and down when you press on them. They are a part of the body. They don't actually move. But they have HTC has special sensors inside the body of the headset, in the body of the handset that can actually feel when you apply pressure with your fingers along the edge of the phone. And so instead of you know, physically pushing in a button to wake up the phone or to turn the phone off, you're actually squeezing in that area, and the pressure that you're applying is enough to make it act as though a button had been pressed.
How do you like it?
I don't.
Okay.
It does not work very well at all.
Okay.
There's been talk from HTC that this is unfinished software. This phone has not actually been released yet, so there may be a software update that helps address this and make it feel better. But it just doesn't feel... You are going through all of the motion of pushing a button. Like you have to line your finger up at the right area and squeeze the phone in a specific way as though you are pressing a button. But none of the actual satisfaction associated with pressing a button. And that also means that you're waiting on software to do things. So things like increasing and decreasing the volume, it's actually slower to increase and decrease the volume on this phone than it would be on, say, the last phone that HTC made that had physical buttons. Because you can't really like rapid fire squeeze this button. The software just doesn't recognize it every time.
Well, why did they do it? Well, who cares? Why do they do stuff like this?
It's trying new things. HTC last year, was the first phone where you could squeeze the bottom of the phone to get a particular action to happen. And that was actually kind of cool. It works in a lot of different ways. But this definitely feels like an attempt to do away with parts that are otherwise easily broken and therefore more expensive to replace. And so this could have been kind of aimed in that general direction, but it really just, as an idea, was not ready to give to people yet. It is a very awkward feeling phone when you go to do things like play with the volume or just wake the phone up.
I suppose, yeah, I mean, not having that button means it's less access for moisture and that kind of thing, too.
It can be, yeah, and that does increase the potential for a phone to be more waterproof than most of the phones that we have today, but... It's an awkward trade-off for now, that's for sure.
Have other phones done this?
No, not like this. We've never had a phone that just didn't have any buttons at all.
Is anybody like it?
It is a very pretty phone. It is visually a very, you know, nice-looking phone in a bunch of different colors, and so there are people who appreciate that. And HTC has a small but loyal following of users who are going to appreciate this phone. But no, I don't think this is going to be a phone that does particularly well in its current form.
Fitbit has a wrist tracker for kids. Wow, there's a market for you. It's called Ace. It's the first tracker designed specifically for kids. What's different about it than the one for adults?
Well, I mean, the first thing is the size. You know, the size of the band naturally has to be smaller for smaller wrists, and that means creating bands that aren't going to have a whole bunch of excess material. But also the software that's running on it has a more child-friendly focus. That means giving tools for parents to be able to see what's, you know, happening with their activity throughout the day, giving kids more appropriate workout challenges and targets for things, encouraging, things like 9 hours of sleep a night or the ability to survive, you know, splashes and be generally waterproof in the shower.
Right. What are some age-appropriate workouts for kids? What do we need? What are we talking about there?
Out of the box, the activity goal is to have 60 minutes of just kind of general motion activity per day. So being able to detect that you have at the very least been up and walking around and doing something for at least 60 minutes is kind of the default thing out of the box. Not necessarily running or jogging or running or anything like that, but those features are able to be recorded just like any other Fitbit. But the other thing is the sleep component. Like I said, it starts out with it gives you a score based on how long you sleep every night, with the goal being to sleep for 9 hours.
Now, what does your board of, what do your counselors at home say about this?
I haven't felt the need to put a fitness tracker on my kid. I feel like they're pretty active as it is. I can appreciate, maybe an older group, kind of older middle school and beginning of high school, appreciating something like this. If for no other reason than to compete with each other in the Fitbit family account, to say, I was more active than you today. I can see that being advantageous, but so far it's not been something that I've put on any of my kids yet.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about tech today with Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. If you have a tech question for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Maybe you mentioned this and I didn't catch it, Russell, but as far as the Fitbit for kids go, are they fun colors? I mean, are they somehow more attractive to kids? Do they have a different scale?
Yeah, so they're designed to be a little smaller, and they are actually nicer colors, in my opinion. A lot of the Fitbits will come in this kind of gray and black and with, like, a silver option. This comes in a purple and a blue, which Fitbit refers to as power purple and electric blue. And I do think, in particular, the purple is this kind of very deep color with accents on the side that looks very nice. And the blue is very similar. But they're going to be available either on Fitbit's website or in Best Buy and Amazon and a bunch of other places. And they start at about $100. So it's cheaper than a comparable Fitbit for adults. But trying to buy one and fit it on my wrist was not going to work.
Okay. And cheaper, you say it starts at $100. What does it go up to?
They're planning on releasing more active versions later. So right now, this is the only version that you can get. But if you know, like the Fitbit versions that have, versions like the Iconic that look more like a watch, there's an expectation that we'll see that later this year.
You wrote about the best Android phones without a notch. What's a notch?
So it started with the Essential phone for last year. And then we saw it with the iPhone X, and now a couple of other companies have started doing it as well. These phones that have almost the entire front of the phone is the display, except for this little bit up top where the camera and the sensors and everything kind of comes into the top of the display a little bit, leaving this weird kind of divot at the top of the screen that has been lovingly referred to by so many people who just really don't like it as the notch. That is a notch cut into the display, basically.
All right. So why so that people don't like the notch?
No, it creates a space on the screen when you hold the phone a certain way that is not an even proportional look, and it makes it so that you can't use the entire display to do things like watch a video without part of the screen being missing. There are a couple of different reasons that it's just not aesthetically pleasing. And so there has just been an incredible amount of people who really just do not care for this design.
So what are the best Android phones without a notch?
Well, for those, it actually starts with Samsung. Samsung had a really great answer to whether the company was ever going to make a phone with a notch, and that was that they really liked, you know, they were the first company to do this kind of edge-to-edge display thing with the Galaxy S7 and then the Galaxy S8 and S9. So they're going to keep that design instead of going for a phone with a notch, which makes the Galaxy S9 right now the best phone that you can get, you know, without a notch. And you can know that, you know, if you decide to wait for the next version, that it is almost assuredly not going to have a notch as well. And then Google Pixel phones are also pretty good designs for now.
I mean, people are getting to be so explicit about what they want in a phone.
Well, it's a weird thing. You know, you think about how many people use their phone to watch media now, in particular, you know, sitting on a lunch break watching Netflix or, you know, stuck on a train watching the news or something like that. It is really weird to sit and watch a television that has a piece of it missing. You know, you wouldn't buy a television that had, you know, kind of a 2-inch cut into the screen because everything would look strange when you go to watch that. And so it's that same kind of experience. It's very odd, and some people just really cannot shake the look.
Okay. Let's see. We have a question from somebody about the E3. Email from Jack in Arlington says, I get the sense that Sony and Microsoft are always competing at these conferences. Been to a few. Who's getting more positive reaction right now?
Oh, I would say of the two, Microsoft definitely had the more positive reaction. They announced so many games at E3 this year. I think they announced 50 different games within the span of an hour and a half. And it was just an impressive kind of barrage of things that made people very happy. So I think that they have the most attention for the moment. But it's actually, the event itself isn't over. Nintendo is giving a presentation later today. And they usually can draw quite a bit of excitement as well. So for right now, I would say Microsoft, if such a thing was possible, has won E3 so far.
And Jack also wants to know, what games do I need to get? Top five, thanks.
What games do you need to get for this? Okay, top five. That's a tough choice.
That's a lot, Jack.
Yeah. So I would start with definitely getting Kingdom Hearts 3. I was a big fan of that series. If you are on an Xbox, Gears of War 5 and Rage 2 and Fallout 76 all look really good, but are all also kind of weirdly, darkly, you know, kind of post-apocalyptic things. But then if you're leaning more towards PlayStation, then the Spider-Man game Last of Us 2 and this really cute free game that comes out, I think, in 2 weeks called The Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit.
I like the name of it.
Is a very uplifting looking story with a little boy who uses his imagination as a superpower. And so he kind of is walking around the real world and you like visually are going back and forth between this imagination power that he has. It was very cool.
Okay. Let's see. Mehmet, you're on the air, Mehmet, with Russell Holly. Hello.
Hi, Russell. Hi, Anne. My question is about these wearable technologies or Fitbit technologies for kids. Mm-hmm. For example, let's say you're in a public place. My 4-year-old is, if I'm not looking at him, he's just disappearing, and I cannot find him for a while, just looking for him. So I'm imagining if he had a Fitbit kind of wristband, and it is connected like Bluetooth to my phone, so I can track them or can see they're away from me, so it will just give me a signal or something like that. Are there this kind of, you know, tracking devices or Bluetooth or, you know,
yeah, that's really interesting.
Space?
Yeah,
thank you very much. For time.
Yeah, thank you, Mehmet. Russell,
there are actually a couple that you can get that offer either this or a similar kind of function, and we've seen a couple others that are coming out this year. The first is the LG Gizmo Pal 2. That's actually one that you can get either on Verizon or another carrier, and it is a wristwatch style thing that can be worn. And because it is GPS built in, it you know, will give information back to the phone about where it is, but also give you the ability to call the watch in case you're separated, so that you can actually talk to them through that watch. Another one is going to have its own monthly subscription very soon from Republic Wireless. It is called Relay. And instead of being like a phone or a wristwatch or something, it's actually a small like speaker that they can fit in their bag or fit in their pocket or something like that. And it gives the kid a bunch of different features, like a smart assistant, the ability to stream music, but it is primarily, you know, this kind of GPS accessory and speaker system so that you can call the child even when you're not close to one another.
Amy Jurovitz says, just implant a chip when they are born. That's, yeah, creepy. But, you know, Mehmet has a real issue. I think it's interesting. I'm glad he called and asked the question because, you know, technology is your friend sometimes, right?
When it comes to this kind of thing, yeah, you can have a lot of flexibility when it comes to being able to keep an eye on your child without it being this kind of constant monitoring system. Mm-hmm. It's really just an occasional check-in. And that can be really beneficial for a lot of different reasons. Even if you know they're just away on a field trip for the day or something, having that kind of extra peace of mind is helpful.
We have an email from Joseph. He says, I've been trying to love my new HomePod as the sound quality is great and I'm already comfortable with Siri use. But the connectivity is so inconsistent. I've had to re-add the device 2 or 3 times a week.
Wow. You've had to re-add the device 2 or 3 times a week?
Yeah, that sounds like a problem. Yeah.
That's definitely an unusual experience from my own testing. I would probably contact Apple directly about that.
Hmm. Okay. Joseph, this is like too many times. Contact Apple. Russell Holly said. Russell Holly, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Net neutrality is over in the U.S. The Federal Communications Commission in December voted to kill the Obama-era rules, intended to ensure a level playing field for internet service providers and their customers. Without controls, internet providers will be free to control access to the internet. I should say without regulations, internet providers will be free to control access to the internet, what we see and the speed at which we can see it. A dozen states have broken ground on their own net neutrality rules, and the state of Washington already has a new law in place. Motherboard staff writer Kaylee Rogers has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. So as far as net neutrality for people who haven't been paying attention, we know it maintains a level playing field, but what exactly is net neutrality?
Net neutrality is basically the principle that everyone should be able to access the same internet the same way. So if you're in a region where there's only one internet service provider and that internet service provider maybe has its own streaming service, for example, they can't block you from going to Netflix because they would rather you using their service, right? So that's what net neutrality preserves. But without those protections in place, they could technically do that, or they could throttle your speeds, or they could block certain content that they think is not, you know, aligning with their ethics. There's a lot of different things that they could do to restrain your access that people don't want, obviously, to be happening.
Well, people don't want it, but the FCC voted against it. FCC before that had embraced net neutrality for more than a decade. It adopted those rules in 2015. What are the arguments against net neutrality?
Well, the FCC's main sort of argument for why it decided to repeal it was it felt that it wasn't the FCC's place to be enforcing this, and that it makes more sense for the FTC to be governing over ISPs and how they do their business. And they sort of pointed to, you know, the FTC used to do it, so why don't they just continue? The problem is that the FTC wasn't great at doing it, and they also don't have any net neutrality laws in place. So it was kind of this retroactive, something would happen, people would complain about it, and then the FTC would look into it and sort of try and decide if it was legal or not based on other kinds of regulations that aren't really specific to the internet.
What does it mean for everyday people? From what I've read, it's not something like we're going to notice it today.
Exactly. So because there's still so much controversy around it and such a close eye on it, I wouldn't expect that any ISP is going to do something drastic right now because everyone's going to notice and they're going to call it out. But over time, we might see subtle changes starting to happen. And this is something that's happened in the past. You know, like AT&T tried to block subscribers with iPhones from using FaceTime because they wanted them to use their service instead. And Verizon once blocked text from a pro-choice organization that was trying to send a message out to its supporters who had signed up. So there's small little specific examples in the past that we could see happening again because there's no legal reason why they can't do these kinds of things. So it's not something you'll notice tomorrow. Your internet's not going to shut down. You're not going to be able to not access Facebook. But subtly, you might start to notice some shifts over the next year or two.
What do the big players say about this, that how they're going to change things? How are they trying to soothe the nerves of people out there?
The major telecom companies are trying to say, look, we believe in net neutrality too. Don't worry. You don't have to have laws in place for us to be nice and behave. You know, I think a lot of Americans are skeptical about that and don't necessarily trust these companies to do the right thing without some kind of government oversight. But that's really the message that they've been trying to send, that these laws are limiting in some ways, that they, you know, somehow prevent innovation, which hasn't been shown to be true, and that it's better to just not have any laws and just trust the independent companies to do the right thing.
And as far as the Federal Trade Commission goes, you said they'll assume the FCC's role here. Is the FTC going to be beefed up in any way to take on this extra work?
No, and the thing is, you know, as I said, there's no specific regulations within the FTC. So if they had their own net neutrality rules, that might be something to consider, but they don't. They're just basing this off of other kinds of consumer protection laws that are more broad and more general and, you know, kind of doing their best, but it's not really equipped to regulate in this way.
The repeal of net neutrality, the decision to do that in December, triggered a new state law in Washington. It was enacted in March, and it went into effect once the federal rules changed yesterday. Mm-hmm. What does the state of Washington do now?
So the state of Washington adopted basically the same language that the FCC used to have federally, which says if you're an ISP operating in this state, you cannot block information. You cannot throttle users. You cannot slow down traffic because you want to, you know, have users use your product instead of another one. It's really clear sort of broad language. It just says you can't do that. Net neutrality is in effect here. And if you try and do that, then that's going to be against Washington state law. So they just went ahead and kind of replaced the old federal rule with one locally.
And other states, there's a couple dozen other states that are considering, I don't think Ohio is among them, but that are considering similar types of efforts?
Yeah, so there are a number of states that are either considering different efforts. There's some where where they've passed executive orders that sort of broadly talk about it or talk about any ISP that has a contract with the state, they have to abide by net neutrality. There's also, you know, Oregon has already passed its law. It won't go into effect till next year, but it has passed. And, yeah, I mean, California, New York, Illinois, a number of states are sort of past the first mark and are getting close to signing these protections into law. The only trouble is that the FCC did have language in its original repeal that kind of prohibited this, that said states can't override their decision. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see if the FCC kind of pushes back on that or tries to sue these states for going ahead.
There seems to be a bipartisan effort in terms of support for net neutrality in Congress. What does that look like?
Yeah, so the Senate was able to pass a resolution under the Congressional Resolution Act where they can basically overturn the FCC's decision. You know, they can just say, well, we don't agree. You have to go back to what you were doing before. And they were able to get that past the Senate through some bipartisan support, and now it's sitting in the House, which faces a much more difficult climb. In general, this is an issue that Democrats are more supportive of and Republicans are a little less interested in. So the House is a much more difficult place to pass this kind of legislation. But they're hoping to at least push it to a vote so that people can see where the representatives lie, if they are interested in supporting net neutrality or if they're not showing up for it. Because this is an issue that voters across the board are very much in favor of. There's been polls that have found 83% of Americans of, you know, any kind of political stripes are in favor of net neutrality. So it's something that's really popular among the people. Mm-hmm. It's just not as easy to get past at the federal level.
Herschel in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Herschel.
Hi. So let's get a couple of basic things. I've been in computers for 40 years. So the internet's not free. Okay. So let's get that out of the way. It's taken billions of dollars to get the infrastructure that's called the internet. So Yahoo, Google, et cetera, are freeloaders on infrastructure that has been put in place. And so that infrastructure has been paid for by corporations, and those corporations were publicly regulated under PUCO in the state of Ohio, Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, as regulated enterprises, mm-hmm. whereas ISPs have always fought the whole idea early of being under regulation until the Googles, the Yahoos, the LinkedIns wanted to have it free, that they didn't have any regulation where they didn't pay any money to the Universal Fund or pay any money to have the internet being free.
Okay.
So these, so when you talk about net neutrality, what you're talking about is organizations who are riding on top of somebody else's investment, okay, and that they want to have it so that their free service is free and equal to the company that may be providing you that linkage, and that that has to pay for that infrastructure.
Kaylee Rogers?
Is there a question there? Or?
I don't know. But the point is that it's not just about the virtues of an open net neutrality issue. Somebody paid for this, and shouldn't we have to pony up and pay to have access to all of it?
Absolutely. And it's not about having free as in not paying for access. It's about having free access as in once you're online, somebody else doesn't get to dictate what you say and what you do and what you view.
Mm-hmm. So is that
that's covered under First Amendment rights. And that, again, you're paying for access. OK. And in terms of net neutrality doesn't speak to your First Amendment rights. Net neutrality says that if I am your last provider of access to the World Wide Web,
mm-hmm.
that I cannot prioritize products that people who are paying me to prioritize products to you. Is that not mm-hmm. true?
Right. So you're okay. saying that's
so,
the
so
way it should
that,
be.
Isn't that capitalism?
Well, it is capitalism. Okay. Yeah, I guess okay. it's just about how you value the internet. Do you?
Oh, but then it's not free. I mean, see that's
okay.
That's
all right, but what are you suggesting then? Are you suggesting
see, there's a thing called the Universal Fund? Okay, that that's a model for the common carriers where each call that you make, okay, that there is a fund that pays for
okay.
when you see these low incomes. So what you create is you can create, like in the state of Ohio, and what they're doing in Oregon and what they've done in Washington is that they said that if you have a public contract to provide internet service, intranet, for the government,
mm-hmm.
that you're required to do X, Y, and Z. It's called community benefit agreements. Okay, and that you're required to be part of a public access based on okay. means tested.
All right.
Okay.
All right. So, Kaylee, are these topics of conversation around the states?
Absolutely. And, I mean, this is the suggestion made there is something that other states have gone through with already in order to have at least some protection. So the trouble is that any ISP that isn't working with the state government and doesn't have any kind of contracts isn't forced to adhere to those regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of depends on how you view the internet, if you view it as a product or if you view it as more like a utility. You know, the FCC made these changes by clearly saying that they don't believe that the internet is a utility. A lot of people would disagree with that. It sort of depends on your point of view.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Herschel, for that call. We appreciate it. Email from Anthony, who says, who regulated the internet before net neutrality came along? Who will take the FCC's place? Of course, we've already established the FTC. Will this change with another president in charge? Which is, you know, kind of that larger question, Kaylee Rogers. What's to stop the next FCC from changing back to net neutrality?
The only thing there is that it was difficult to get it established in the first place. This took a lot of active campaigning.
Back in 2015, yeah.
Mm-hmm, and 2014, mm-hmm. and the previous chair who was appointed by President Barack Obama was still not sure about it. It took a lot of convincing to get them to decide to go forward with these protections, and so it wouldn't necessarily be that easy to just flip back the other way after, you know, if there was some kind of change down the line. I think the more likely scenario would be if something were to happen through Congress or through the many lawsuits that have been launched from states against the FCC for overturning this decision.
And if I start logging onto the internet and I want to Google something and I get a list of, you know, hits or a list of links, will someone tell me if I'm not getting all the links or will I just not know?
I think it would be hard to know. The more likely scenario where you'll be able to identify it is if there's somewhere that you regularly go and you're finding that that access is being blocked. So a lot of people that use peer sharing services online in the past have had that blocked for various reasons and have been able to report it and regain access. And often the ISP says, oh, it was a mistake. We didn't mean to do that. So keeping an eye on any kind of service that doesn't seem to be working or seems to be much slower than normal, mm-hmm. those would be signs that there could be something up.
What do they do in other countries?
Other countries have net neutrality rules, not every country, obviously. And generally, that's sort of considered the best baseline practice. You know, it's not going to cover everything, and not everybody's going to like it, but it's sort of the bare minimum standard for internet access that you can't prevent people from using the internet the way they want to use it, even though you have to pay to get access. Once you've paid to get that access, you have to have complete access. They can't decide how you use it.
And one of the arguments for repealing net neutrality has been it will increase investment in innovation. What are they talking about there? Does that have something to do with what Herschel was talking about?
The problem is that has not been actually proven with statistics. That's something that a lot of the big telecom companies have been pushing, saying, like, because there are certain rules, it makes it hard for, say, a small startup ISP to get into the market because, I don't know, I guess it's just more regulation that they have to deal with. You know, in general, businesses mm-hmm. prefer less regulation, so I guess that's sort of their point of view. But we haven't seen that. And what happens is, without net neutrality, the established incumbent big ISPs have more of an opportunity to take advantage of the market, and that actually makes it more difficult for small new companies to get into the field because they're blocking them, they're blocking access to different things, or they're doing things like zero rating where they're saying, oh, sign up with us and you get Netflix for free for the first year. Mm-hmm. And then the small ISP next door, they can't afford to do that, so they're just not even going to get any of the competition.
Will it matter if a state like California decides to get involved in this?
California's got a law in the works, and it's actually the most broad of any of the state legislations that I've seen. So it's passed the state Senate and is at the House now and will likely pass. So that would be significant, and I know that New York is planning on following suit and basically copying the language and just doing the same thing here.
The other biggie, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So that I think that might have a bit of a persuasive effect on other areas. I also think that really the midterms are going to be an interesting time to see, you know, officials could see if their constituents care about this. If they vote against net neutrality and then win their election anyway, that's a pretty big sign that, you know,
it didn't
their
matter.
Voters don't mind and vice versa. So I think that this is going to be a good opportunity to sort of test how people are feeling about it and how significant it is to them.
Kaylee Rogers, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kaylee Rogers, staff writer for Motherboard, has been writing about net neutrality or the lack thereof now in the United States, except for the state of Washington. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.